this morning is Psalm 49. So we'll read that now. To the choir master, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom, the meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre. Why should I fear in times of trouble, when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches. Truly, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice. That he should live on forever and never see the pit. For he sees that even the wise die, the fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others, their graves and their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they call lands by their own names. Man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. Yet after them, people approve of their boasts. Selah. Like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol, with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Selah. Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases, and when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed, and though you get praise when you do not well, do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers, who will never again see light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. I'm going to hand over to Des. Thanks, Des.
Thank you, Neil. If you do have your Bibles, please have them open at that 49th Psalm, which we want to look at this morning. Now, the 49th Psalm informs us in the title that it's a psalm of the sons of Korah, or for the sons of Korah, those men who were appointed by David specifically for liturgical purposes in the temple, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago. And the title also tells us that it was to the choir master, one who would have arranged the psalms with other psalms to be sung in the temple with special occasions in mind. What's unusual about this psalm, though, is that whereas most other psalms offer worship to God, this one rather offers instructions to men. And what's more, the instruction the psalmist offers here is arranged in a way that's very much like the way the teacher, the wisdom teacher in the book of Proverbs, offered his instructions. Look at verse 1. Hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. Verse 2. My mouth shall speak wisdom. The meditations of my heart shall be understanding. And then verse 3. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre. So you can see the psalmist here is using that familiar two-line rhythmic arrangement as the wisdom teacher in the book of Proverbs used. But then, unlike the book of Proverbs, the psalmist here puts his teaching to music. Verse 3, I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre. So we might say then that this psalm is a musical proverb, with the psalmist having inclined his ear and after deep meditation has gained understanding into something he calls a riddle, and which he intends to express in terms of wisdom, all set to music. And so, like the Proverbs, which are essentially wise instructions for life, the psalmist wants his hearers also to learn something that is very important for life also. What does he want us to learn? What's this riddle he's solved after meditating and gaining understanding and now intends to teach? Well, firstly, notice that it's a riddle, a lesson that he wants all people to learn. And just like the teacher of wisdom in Proverbs, this teacher's message is aimed at all people, everywhere, and indeed at all times. So in other words then, it's not just for the Hebrews who trace their ancestry through Abraham, but to all humanity, which traces its ancestry back to Adam. Verse 1. Hear this, all peoples. Then so as we don't misunderstand him by thinking he's saying something like this, hear all peoples of Israel, he then says, give ear, all inhabitants of the world. So Jew and Gentile alike. But then to underline his universal call and leave no room for anyone who might say, oh, pardon me, I didn't realize you were including me in that call, he used a somewhat rare word that's found in Psalm 17 and verse 14, and which is translated, which is we could put something like this. Men of this world whose portion is this life. And the point is, he's speaking to all who share a common humanity, all whose portion is this life. Or if you like, all who share in mortality, and not simply those who share a common geography. So the psalmist wants all people, everywhere, and irrespective of their nationality, to hear what his meditations, his understanding, and his wisdom has to teach about in the riddle that he solved. But then notice that the psalmist's intended audience also includes all people from every strata of life. Verse 2. Both low and high, rich and poor together. So he's indicating that nobody is exempt from his teaching. And again, it's almost as if he's anticipating someone saying something like, oh, I do beg your pardon. I thought you were talking to those important people or to those learned people, not to a simple person like myself. On the other hand, he may have had in mind someone who says, oh, you mean me as well? I thought your lesson was for the unlearned, for the people who need an education, not for academics like us. Or maybe he anticipated someone thinking, surely he's not talking to us successful, cultured folk. We who have done well and are pillars of respect in society, surely he doesn't think we have anything to learn from him. For conversely, perhaps he anticipates some penniless beggar saying, what's learning to do with me? It's enough just to survive. Never mind giving some pointless lessons to learn. No, the psalmist says his lesson is for all peoples, of all nationalities, and from every strata of society, low and high, rich and poor, together. So having established then that the psalmist's message is a universal message that excludes none, but includes all, the question is, what's he saying? What's he on about? And what the psalmist is on about is introduced in the fifth verse. And you'll notice that the way he presents his subject is in the same way, again, as the wise teacher of Proverbs sometimes has presented his teachings, with the interrogative message, with the interrogative method. And he began by asking, began with the interrogative why. And that why tells us what had so troubled the psalmist to such a degree that he should speak of his concern that he's worked out as being a riddle. Now, a riddle, by definition, is a question or statement intentionally phrased so as to require ingenuity in answering, in ascertaining its answer or meaning. Let me say that again. It's a bit of a mouthful. A riddle, by definition, is a question or statement intentionally phrased so as to require ingenuity in ascertaining its answer or meaning. So an example of a riddle might be something like this. Everyone wants more of it to feel special, yet the more you have of it, the less special you feel. So it's a question posed that requires ingenuity to arrive at its answer. In other words, the answer isn't obvious. It isn't easy. And it takes some contemplation, some meditation to solve the riddle. And so in this instance here, the it in the riddle, that everyone wants to more of it to feel special. Yet the more that you have of it, the less special you'd feel, is knowledge. It teaches you that the more knowledge you gain, the more you realize how unknowledgeable you are and the less special you feel. And arriving at that answer through meditating on the question imparts understanding. And so the psalmist, by asking this question in verse 5, tells us what had been troubling him in such a way that he should think of it as a riddle. Verse 5, why should I fear when times of trouble, when the iniquities of those who cheat me surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches? And as you read on through the psalm, you see that he brings up these things in various other places. Verse 16, be not afraid when a man becomes rich and the glory of his house increases. And so what had set the psalmist on a downward spiral of thought was when he saw the riches and the comfort and the power increase in the wicked. An increase which brought praise and adulation from their peers, verse 18, but also harm to himself in spite of his righteous life, verse 5. And it seems that circumstances that so presented, where the psalmist who had lived a righteous life found himself personally cheated, troubled, and threatened by those who had lived very unrighteous lives. These were they who, verse 5, were causing him personal loss whilst they grew richer using unfair methods. He says they were cheating him. Now, we're not told exactly what was transpiring. And it could have been something as basic as tampered weights for measuring out grain, where they were cheating him for what he had paid. It could have been a concern over enlarging of territory over set boundaries, theirs over his, the moving of boundary stones. It may have been a question of injustice or injury requiring compensation and they went paying up. Or perhaps matters to do with the Mosaic law concerning a ransom paid. Because if you look closely at the psalm and the psalmist's complaint, all of these things are somewhat hinted at very subtly from verse 5 to the end. But at the end of the day, we have to say, we don't know. But whatever the reason for the psalmist's complaint, one thing is clear, and it's that the psalmist is being treated unfairly by those who have sheer weight of numbers and the luxury of riches and brute power on their side. It's the age-old problem, isn't it? Of the powerful treating the weak with contempt, and the weak being unable to do anything about the way that they've been treated. And the psalmist here describes these people very clearly. He says they were they who, verse 5, cheat. They manipulate for profit at the expense of the weak. Verse 6, they were rich and boasted in the abundance of their riches. Verses 11 and 16, they had sumptuous houses and even lands named after them. Verse 12, they were pompous, proud, self-exalting in word and in lifestyle. Verse 13, they had an unsound sense of confidence, a false confidence about themselves. And verses 13 and 18, they had acolytes who encouraged their boasting. Probably people like themselves or people who wanted to be like them. And because of their abundance, their power and their popularity, they seem to have become a law to themselves at the expense of the weak and the humble who couldn't do anything about it. So these are the circumstances that move the psalmist to meditate in his heart and to gain understanding. The result of his contemplations is his composing of this riddle for life. Very well. Well, we've looked at the fact that the psalmist is addressing all people. And we've considered the reason that brought him here. The problems he faced had brought him to contemplate and to compose his riddle. So then thirdly, we need to ask, what is the psalmist's riddle? What is his question or statement intentionally phrased so as to require ingenuity in answering it? And I suppose if I were to attempt a paraphrase of the psalmist's riddle, I would say something like this in the words of Jesus, Matthew 16 and verse 26. There Jesus said this, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? What shall a man give in return for his soul?" Now that's a riddle. That's a riddle worth contemplating. But now look at what Jesus said in parabolic form about a seemingly intelligent man who did just that. We find that passage in Luke chapter 12 and verses 13 to 21. But they had taken it up at verse 16. We read this. "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I'll do this. I'll tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I'll store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.'" And there we have a picture of a man who's worked hard, an intelligent man. He anticipated trouble, and he made every provision for when times might get tight, or when he wouldn't have his youth to sustain his lifestyle when old age came upon him. And so we might say that this man applied his natural abilities, his intelligence, his lessons learned from life. And he engaged his opportunities so as to do well and so as to ensure that as he lived, so he would die, comfortable, satisfied, carefree. What did Jesus say about that seemingly impressive man? Fool. Verse 20, fool. That's what Jesus said about that man. Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you've prepared, whose will they be? Then the postscript, same verse. So is the one or anyone who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. You see, there's the crux of the riddle, the worth of a soul, and the price of a soul compared to anything else. And that's why the psalmist is concerned to express his meditations to everyone, Jew and Gentile, high or low, rich or poor, because everyone has a soul. And no matter how hard you might try to argue it away, it's a fact. I remember reading a biography of Dr. Lloyd Jones when he was studying as a medical doctor. And a well-known instructor would say to him and say to the class repetitively, I've dissected many bodies, but I've never found a soul. But you can't argue it away. And you can't blot out the fact of his existence through drinking or drugs or sex or riches or fame or the applause that others have as to your worth, because the niggling problem still remains. And that everyone has a sense that they're made for better things than just food and drink and the applause of this world. That there's more to life than this work and sleep and death. And the reason for that niggle is because every person, high and low, rich or poor, has an intangible, precious, immortal soul. That God-given spiritual identity, which can never be satisfied simply by what the natural, physical, and temporal things of this life can offer. You see, that's what separates man from the rest of animal creation. Because man alone of all creatures was made in the image of God. God formed man and breathed into man the breath of life. And when he made man, he made him for eternity with an eternal soul. And nothing in the realm of all creation, no matter how impressive, how costly, can ever compare to the preciousness of a man's soul, of man made in the image of God. And ultimately, whilst man is meant in his image bearing, not merely to have dominion over all the earth, to rule over the earth, the creation, and enjoy it, first and foremost, he's made to worship and to enjoy God always. But that's unfortunately where, because of our fallen and sinful natures, that universal disease we all share in and trace back to Adam, and because of our finite and physical compositions, that's where we're all prone to live our lives transfixed on the physical and tangible, while rarely giving a thought to the spiritual and the eternal. It's a state the Bible describes as spiritual blindness, ignorance, death, and of being in bondage to or enslaved to sin. Listen how the Apostle Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 3. The God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing. And Paul's inference is that the devil who seduced Adam to sin through fleshly desire continues to hold sinners in that state of spiritual blindness by seducing them to thirst after and contemplate and to enjoy only that which the flesh wants: food, drink, sex, riches, fame, comfort. so that in varying degrees, the lives of those in that natural state are characterized by the lives of the unrighteous in this 49th Psalm. In fact, if you were to look at how Paul described all who live without thought for God in Romans 3, you'd find a scathing review of how he saw such people, a review that makes the psalmist here seem almost complimentary to those who he speaks of. So in a sense, those troublesome ones in Psalm 49 are but descriptive of all mankind without God. They're descriptive of the natural trajectory of sin in man when left unchecked. Now, you might say, I'm being quite unfair in my assessment. I guess, you know, there's the odd bad apple, but that the majority of people are good. But my answer to you is that that's not my assessment. That's the biblical assessment of fallen man. And that man without God, as the psalmist says in verse 20, left as he is in his bond, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. You see, what the psalmist is saying is that those who have no thought for their immortal souls and fulfilling what they've been designed for, that is, not just ruling over and having dominion over the earth, but first and foremost knowing and walking in communion with God, these by living entirely to satisfy themselves, their cravings and their desires, these in effect are no different from the beasts who weren't made in God's image and for communion with him, but who were made to simply follow after their beastly instincts. So it's not that man can't do good, rather, but left to himself, without constraint, in the final analysis, he lives to himself. He's driven by his beastly instincts. And if, as in the psalm, satisfying their instincts means treading down the poor or the righteous or the weak, then left unchecked, he has the natural propensity to do just that. And in the frustration he was enduring, the iniquity of the rich, unchecked, growing richer, boasting, cheating, and in his sufferings as a righteous man, powerless to do anything about it, the psalmist focusing on the painful realities of life, and losing sight of the eternal realities, sunk down into a state of fear and desperation. But it was at that point of despair, like the writer of the 73rd Psalm, when he entered the sanctuary of God, when this psalmist remembered the whole picture, viewed from eternity, and that he brought forth his riddle. And the riddle the psalmist proposes, and as I've already hinted at in the words of Jesus, is the riddle of the soul's worth. How much is a soul worth? Can you put a price on it? Is it worth $1,000? $1 trillion? Verse 7 says, truly no man can ransom another or give to God a price for his life, for the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice. There, he's using the word life in the original Hebrew. It's the same word for soul. And he says, their life is costly and can never suffice. So the psalmist, in remembering that he's just in the antechamber to something far greater, says, the worth of a soul is priceless. And remember, Jesus said the same thing, but in a different way, when he rhetorically asked, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? And the unspoken answer, of course, is nothing. It will profit him nothing. If a man could gain the whole world, imagine it, total ownership, total control, the entire planet to use as you will, What will I gain? Nothing. That's what Jesus says. And that's amazing, isn't it? Especially when you see, contemplate how men and women wake up morning by morning to live out their lives. They go to work, they do what they do, they buy, they sell, then to indulge their sensual desires. And then they have children and teach them to engage everything at their disposal and to do the same with their lives, as if that's all there is to life. But if that's all there is to life, then it's nothing, Jesus says. And so here's the riddle. The pricelessness of something invisible and the worthlessness of gaining everything. Let me ask you then this morning, how do you measure riches? What values do you have? What value do you put on your immortal soul? You see, these are questions worth thinking about in our busy lives. And today, with the rush and tear and the shifting of social values and the violence and the disasters that we see daily, all these things tend to make life seem cheap. And it does us well to stop and to think and to meditate and to ask, are my values biblical values? Does my life express a life lived to something greater than the just the now? Or am I just living as a brute beast driven by instinct? And those questions are worth asking, because how we answer them in our lives in flesh, if you like, acting out what we believe, has eternal consequences. And the eternal consequences are one of two, says the psalmist. Verse 18, speaking of himself as a man who has realized his soul's worth and his creation mandate in its comprehensiveness, not just to have dominion, but also to know and to love God. He says, but God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, and he will receive me. But then by contrast, verse 19, speaking of the wicked, of those who haven't contemplated their soul's worth and live like the beasts who perish, he says, his soul will go to the generations of his fathers who will never again see light. Those are the only two alternatives. Now, it's worth mentioning here that the word Sheol can have a number of connotations. It could mean literally the grave, place where the body is committed. Or it can mean the realm of death, the realm afterlife, the realm not literally in a sense, but a realm of not living, if you like, the not live, those who've passed on. And it can also mean hell, the place of final and eternal punishment. And while we would be on thin ground to say that the psalmist had in mind hell here, given that it's not until the New Testament that we have a full-blown understanding of the afterlife, he says enough to speak of his soul being received by God, whereas the wicked will never again see light. And that's a thought he's previously expressed concerning the eternal state of the soul after death in verses 14 and 15. And where he said, like sheep, the wicked, are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol, with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from Sheol, for he will receive me. So then the psalmist's call is to all people, because all have a soul. And he came to express his teaching because of the injustices he was suffering at the hand of the wicked. People who were like half people, living like the beasts of the earth, fulfilling only one half of their creation mandate, living as if they were soulless and only driven by animal instinct. He then presented his findings in what I've termed the riddle of the soul's worth, that a soul is both priceless and eternal, and that once disconnected or disembodied from that perishable body, will continue on eternally in either one of two states, a state of comfort or a state of suffering. But the last thing that can't be omitted is the word the psalmist used often, ransom, with regard to the soul. And he used that in verses 7, 8, and 15. And like the use of the word Sheol, the word ransom doesn't take on its full biblical meaning until the New Testament. In the Old Testament, it carried with it the meaning of buying back or redeeming, and was often used with regard to civil law, where the redeemer or the kinsman redeemer had certain rights above others to redeem lands or even relatives. Redemption means a price being paid in order to purchase back something that was lost. But those who know their Bibles well know that in the New Testament, the fulfillment of all those Old Testament types of redeemer and redemption are found in Jesus Christ, the redeemer of sinners. He said of himself, didn't he, that he came to redeem what was lost and that his life was given as a ransom for many. And that redemption that he accomplished through his life being laid down for others, when he offered himself as a sacrifice for sinners on the cross, when he paid the redemption price for our punishment for us. And in the gray of the Old Testament, where all the details of the coming Redeemer had yet haven't fully been disclosed, yet they were given hints. And in verse 15, one of those hints are found where the psalmist said, "But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me." And he used the word Sheol here, probably meant the grave. God will ransom my soul from the power of a grave. That is, soul wouldn't inhabit the grave. Rather, that God would receive his eternal soul when it departed from his mortal body, and that God himself would welcome him. What a wonderful thought that is for all who truly know God. That because the kinsman redeemer, and because of what he accomplished on the cross, that their souls will, through the process of mortality running its course, will find at the end of it what it is to be with Christ forever. And what a cost. The suffering and atoning death of the Redeemer, God's one and only Son, Jesus Christ. What's the worth of a soul to God? This, that it took nothing less than the eternal Word, the second person of the divine and triune Godhead, to take on flesh and to die that horrific atoning death in order to save it. That's the worth of a soul. Well then, why did the psalmist say, "Why should I fear in times of trouble?" And the answer to that is because he came to his senses and he knew his kinsman redeemer. And after the fight was fought, and after the dust had all settled around, that God would take him to himself and he would be vindicated over his enemies. Let me ask you then, have you understood the riddle of the soul's worth? Because if you do, you too will agree with the psalmist that this life is but the antechamber. and the best is yet to come. Amen.